This is Solidarity Journal. Share in a common voice. You just might find your own. Well, it's Tuesday, the 24th. This is Solidarity Journal on WAZU. A lot of things have gone on in the news, and we're delivering you just a slice of the pie. These are your headlines. Apocalypse not now. The rapture fails to materialize. Illinois considers selling a state prison. We'll update you on the United States involvement in Libya. For your ears only, my conversation with local author and writer of the labor paper, Chris Stevens. As always, we'll fill you in on local progressive thought and ideas. This is WAZU, Peoria's one and only Pacifica Radio affiliate, and our community voice. You know, I guess on Sunday, when the rapture people feel really upset, we can't console them by saying, cheer up, it's not the end of the world. Christian doomsday prophet Harold Camping looks likely to be less than rapturous after his prediction that the world would end on Sunday failed to materialize. The 89-year-old California preacher had prophesied that the rapture would begin at 6 p.m. in each of the world's time zones, with those saved by Jesus ascending to heaven and the non-believers being wiped out by an earthquake rolling from city to city across the planet. But as the deadline for the apocalypse passed in the Pacific Islands, New Zealand, and Australia, it became apparent that Camping's prediction of the end of the world was to end not with a bang, but with a whimper. You know, all this hoopla going on about this stuff is just a little ridiculous. It's extremely ridiculous. I don't want to hear anything about it. In fact, being born and raised as a Christian, in a Christian home, in a Christian atmosphere, it specifically says, you will not know the time, nor the date. I will come like a thief in the night. You know, so all these people, they're charlatans, you know, these whack jobs promoting an apocalypse, all in their own name, you know, seeking their own righteousness. These folks are fools, absolutely fools. Anybody who believes in them is a sheep. You know, they're just complete ignorant. I don't even know why I'm wasting airtime with this story. Moving right along, something completely interesting.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine.
U.S. operations in Libya hit the 60-day mark Friday, but Congress has grown largely silent on the administration's unilateral intervention into the war-torn North African nation. The 1973 War Powers Act, the statute President Obama invoked when he launched forces in March, requires presidents to secure congressional approval for military operations within 60 days or withdraw forces within the next 30. Congress did not authorize the mission, which includes a no-fly zone, bombing raids, a sea blockade, and civilian protection operations, but the deadline has stirred little sense of urgency on Capitol Hill. House lawmakers are in the midst of a week-long recess, and the Senate, which struck down, is also unlikely to address the issue this week. There has been some congressional action, however. On Thursday, six Senate Republicans wrote to Obama asking him if he intended to comply with the WPA, the War Powers Act. Friday is the final day for the statutory 60-day period for you to terminate the use of the United States Armed Forces in Libya under the War Powers Resolution, reads the letter spearheaded by Senator Rand Paul, Republican from Kentucky. As recently as last week, your administration indicated use of the United States Armed Forces will continue indefinitely. The White House did not respond to request for comment Thursday. Representative Dennis Kucinich, Democrat from Ohio, is another vocal critic of the Libyan intervention. He has vowed to introduce legislation Monday invoking the War Powers Act in an effort to pull U.S. forces from the conflict. At home, people are being told to sacrifice their own quality of life because our government does not have sufficient resources for healthcare, education, retirement, security, and job creation, Kucinich said. Yet at the same time, we are setting the stage for endless war, which will bring ruin and poverty. Breaching the 60-day deadline sets a bad precedent for administrations to come, according to critics on and off Capitol Hill, who are calling on Congress to push back against the president's war-waging powers. Everyone from professors of law and political science at Yale University, Ivy Leaguers across, are chanting the same thing. This is a classic case of what could go wrong with executive war-making. As you all may know, Congress is the ultimate decider of wars, and it's the president's job to bring military measures to Congress so Congress can agree to go forward or not. With longtime Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi threatening to attack those critical of his regime, international forces led by the U.S. launched Aran missile strikes in March to establish a no-fly zone over the North African nation. The U.S. ceded control of the operations to NATO a few days later. At the time, several lawmakers expressed concern that the president had not consulted Congress before acting. Obama on Thursday defended his decision, arguing that thousands of civilians would have been killed at the hands of Gaddafi. In Libya, we saw the prospects of imminent massacre. We had a mandate for action and heard the Libyan people's call for help, the president said in a speech at the State Department. Had we not acted along with our NATO allies and regional coalition partners, thousands would have been killed. Still, naysayers of executive war powers have said that the House could possibly consider this issue on the floor during the defense authorization debate next week. So the debate goes on. Does a president have the power to enact war, or should it be, constitutionally, a power of Congress? I mean, I guess that's where we get to implied powers and expressed powers, where we get to interpretation of the Constitution in the long run. Needless to say, our troops are still over there, and when they'll be coming home, no one knows. But we are nearing a 60-day interval, according to the War Powers Act, mandates our president bring them home, or at least have a plan to. In this 60-day opportunity, the president is mandated by an act that was an act of legislation in 1973 called the War Powers Act. He is mandated to secure congressional approval for military operations or withdraw the troops in 30 days. So we'll see what happens. Will we be coming home or won't we be? Stay tuned for these stories and more like them on Solidarity Journal in weeks to come.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the capital city. It's a long, long wait while I'm sitting in committee. But I know I'll be a law someday. At least I hope and pray that I will. But today I am still just a bill.
Well, the prison price has been set, but payday for Illinois is not soon enough. Governor Pat Quinn and President Barack Obama's administration might have struck a deal on a price for the empty Thompson prison, but Illinois shouldn't expect a check anytime soon. The agreed-upon price of $165 million for the Thompson Correctional Center in the northern corner of the state is less than its appraised value of $220 million. However, Rick Carter, spokesman for the U.S. Representative Don Manzulu, a Republican from the 16th District, said the Illinois congressman has not heard anything about a sale. The federal government doesn't have any money, Carter said. There may be an agreement, but there cannot be a sale without any money to buy the prison. Maybe we won't have to cut some kid's program, because right now we are in the process of cutting $2.4 billion out of our budget, and maybe we will save a few programs that we won't have to cut out, if this sale occurs. In 2001, former Governor George Ryan built Thompson to ease state prison overcrowding, but the prison has sat empty for nearly a decade because of state budget cuts and politics. Let's get it open. Let's put people to work. Let's bring the financial economic impact to our community. That's just one opinion of people in Springfield over the issue. Should we sell it and get large amounts of money? Or should we put people to work with it and stimulate our economy that way? Originally, the Obama administration wanted to use Thompson Prison as a site to house terror suspects from the Guantanamo Bay military prison in Cuba. We can all be thankful that didn't go through. Our U.S. Senator Dick Durbin is working with the Federal Bureau of Prisons to reprogram federal funding to turn Thompson into a federal maximum security prison. Wouldn't that be nice? That would be absolutely terrible. You know, our state legislature and our guys in Springfield, they're continuing to work with the federal government regarding the sale of Thompson Correctional Center. They hope to complete the sale as soon as possible. Looks like we're going to be getting a little more stimulus money, as it were. Who knows what will happen to the prison? Maybe the site will be torn down and used for something else. Maybe it'll indeed become a federal maximum security prison. Thankfully, it won't house Guantanamo Bay terrorist suspects. But, nonetheless, hopefully Illinois will soon be getting some money. We're liquidating some of our assets. And we're on the road to budgetary recovery.
Tonight there's gonna be a jailbreak somewhere in this town. See, me and the boys, we don't like it, so we're getting up and going down. Hide and low, looking right to left. If you see us coming, I think it's best to move away. Do you hear what I say from under my breath? Tonight there's gonna be a jailbreak.
Today I have a special guest, Chris Stevens. He's been working with the AFL-CIO for 17 years. He's a writer for the Labor paper.
Yeah, here in Peoria.
Yes. I'm glad to have him on as a guest today.
Well, thank you for having me, Zach.
Well, thanks for coming.
Yep.
Let's get into some topics here. A little history of labor in Peoria. You probably know a lot about it.
Well, Peoria's certainly got a pretty colorful labor history. There's an awful lot of information that flows out there. Of course, we have UAW 974, which was one of the largest, if not largest, UAW locals for a long time. And have a pretty effective building trades here. That's who I work for at the Labor Paper. We're owned by the Building Trades Council. The carpenters and plumbers and electricians and laborers and steam fitters and so on and so forth. Which, by the way, I'm very proud of.
Yeah.
Because I happen to be a union musician. So I appreciate people that have a skill that they do with their hands.
What's the musicians union?
Well, it's Local 26, but where I live, it's Local 100. I'm a member of Local 100 because I live up in Bradford. So I'm in the Kewaunee local, actually.
What's it called? I mean,
American Federation of Musicians.
Wow, I didn't even know that existed.
Oh, yeah. It's like all skilled trades. If you want to hire those people that have actually had to study it and learn how to do it, you know. I mean,
yeah.
You know, that's what I always say to people about the building trades. You know, you have your choice. You have your choice when you want something built. You can either hire the person that learned how to do it on the job at $12 an hour, or you can hire the person that actually had to go through a structured apprenticeship and a structured learning process and pass tests and meet the criteria that, you know, those that have done it before met, and they can say, okay, you now know how to do this. Pretty simple. You know, I always ask people, you know what, if you were going to have surgery, do you want a heart surgeon that learned on the job, or do you want a guy that went to school and studied what happened before?
Yeah.
End of conversation.
So, some moments in the history of labor in Peoria.
Well, there's been everything from really good moments to really bad moments.
Yeah.
You know, good moments are things like... there used to be just a fantastic Labor Day picnic in Peoria. I mean, Peoria was known as one of the few cities that absolutely, positively had a rousing Labor Day celebration.
Wow.
I'm currently in the process of writing a biography, a very detailed biography of a man named Reuben G. Soderstrom, who was president of organized labor in Illinois for 40 years. And in 1930, when he became president, he had come to Peoria to speak at the Labor Day picnic right at the base of... what's that drive? Peoria Heights.
Grandview Drive,
you know, that park down there.
Yeah.
There were 3,000 people there.
Wow.
And there was music and dancing, and he gave a big, long speech. And
what year was that?
1930.
Wow.
Yeah. And then by the same token, in 1946, when the firemen and engineers went on strike at the TP&W Railroad, you know, there was some serious violence and two strikers, one of them, a man named Pashan that was from Peoria, was killed. Wow. And, you know, they were shot over by Gridley as they were picketing by guards. And then subsequently in that year, George McNear Jr., the manager of the railroad, was actually assassinated in front of his house over on High Street, where it meets Moss Avenue, High Street and Sheridan. So, you know, Peoria has kind of a wide range of labor history.
Do we do anything to celebrate it?
Oh, yeah, there's a Labor Day parade. They reinstituted the Labor Day parade of, I think, 7 or 8 years ago, and now every year on Labor Day. And it's in the afternoon because the one in Galesburg is in the morning. And the one in Galesburg, I believe, is like the second longest running in the country.
Wow.
And so Peoria is pretty long, too, long running, but they stopped it for a number of years. And then they just reinstituted it about 7 or 8 years. Oh, but I think actually about 10 years ago they reinstituted it. Labor is very active in Peoria. A lot of people don't realize the Labor Council stays on top of stuff. There's been rallies down at the courthouse in support of those workers. There's going to be rallies in support of the people at the Red Cross that are trying to get a contract with AFSCME. You know,
yeah, I've been to a lot of the rallies downtown.
Oh, great.
Brought some of the stories back for listeners.
Great.
So what do you write about at the Labor Paper?
Well, we write a variety of issues. We try to always have something local, like this particular issue that will be out, I believe, the 18th or 19th. Is I got a story about a father and a son that got their pins from their service pins from the laborers. One got a 65-year pin, one got a 30-year pin. And so we love doing stories like that because that's about two local guys and, you know, they were in the trades. And then we also write a lot. We try to keep our readers informed of issues that directly affect their life, whether it be workers' comp, unemployment, labor law changes, various things like that. You know, we try to make sure that our readers understand what's going on. And in fact, for your listeners, if you work for a paycheck, whether you're union or not, you should be reading the Labor Paper. Because we focus on dealing with the issues that people that are wage earners should know about.
Yes. Where can you find it at?
I know they have it at the Peoria City Hall. They got it at the County Courthouse. I'm not sure where the other drop spots are, to be real honest with you. You know, I know Haddad's Market used to, but they're just rebuilding that now.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, all union.
All right.
Yeah. Just like the children's hospital that required the skilled guys, you know, in the Interstate 74. You know, I always ask people when they think it's easy to be a union skilled tradesperson. I always ask them, I'll say, well, you know, if you had to redo the interstate, how would you make it all fit together?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, do you realize they did the bridge while they were doing west of town? And it all had to come together at the same spot.
Wow.
That's not an easy task.
No.
But we could talk a little bit about, like, what is going on now, like, with public sector workers. You know, there's clearly an attack. You know, we all witnessed on television and the media the attack against public sector workers and their pensions and so on up in Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah.
And Ohio and Indiana and so on and so forth. You
we
know?
Went to Wisconsin. Solidarity drill.
Yeah, yep, absolutely.
Great atmosphere up there. Lots of unity. Do you feel it trickling down? Do you feel the effects of...
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, that man, I hate to keep referring to it, but the man that I'm writing the book about, Reuben Soderstrom, he coined a phrase in 1947 when they passed Taft-Hartley. He calls it ruling by fooling.
Oh.
And that's exactly what's going on now. If Scott Walker in Wisconsin and John Kasich in Ohio, just to use two examples, would have told the voters what they were going to do when they were elected, they would have never been elected.
That's right.
That's why they're ruling by fooling. They told you, you know, they said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to deal with a deficit, which obviously if you're a taxpaying citizen of Wisconsin or Ohio, you're going to want to deal with. Mm-hmm. And they said, we're going to get spending under control and we're going to make sure your taxes don't go up because we don't want to have to pay this off. Now, of course,
but we're not going to mention that we're going to take it away from public workers.
Yeah, that's what they didn't say. Yeah. Right. They didn't tell you how they were going to do it. Most people are pretty nice. You know, I mean, as a reporter, I've talked to thousands and thousands of people over my life, and I'm telling you, most people want to do the right thing. And so most people thought, well, okay, that's what we ought to do for our state is get spending under control. They didn't realize what it was going to be. It was taking money out of their sister that's a teacher's pension, you know, or out of their brother that's a county worker or a state worker. That's ridiculous. Yeah.
What are the areas that they should fix budgets? Where should they be taking spending from?
I'm not sure they should be taking spending from anything right now. And the reason I say that is that because in a perfect world, people would have to understand, I hope your listeners are sitting down because I'm about to freak them out. They've got it upside down. Government is the only entity that ever creates a job. Private sector's never created a job.
Yeah.
Let me explain.
Yeah,
that's why I hope your listeners are sitting. Okay?
I hope so too.
The government, when they take their tax revenue, which is a different debate how much they have and how they get it, but when they take tax revenue, they send it to Illinois and they say, build high-speed rail. That creates jobs for the people that are going to be building the high-speed rail, installing it, making the products, transporting it, the Teamsters, everybody down the line, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Private sector does not create jobs. Customers create jobs. A man that has the greatest idea in the world and the best pizza sauce you've ever tasted in your life decides to invest his money, rents a little small place, hires three people, opens a pizza place, and for whatever reason, unbeknownst to him, no one buys his pizzas. He's out of business.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't create any jobs. Customers create jobs. And where we get into difficulty in the United States is that a company that, say, is a manufacturing company is both a customer and
an employer.
And the reason is that they sell their products to their customers. Without their customers, they couldn't sell products. But by the same token, if they should outsource some of their work, then they also become the customer.
Mm.
So that's what makes it all difficult. And I think what's happened in the United States is that we've focused so much on the bottom line of profit
mm-hmm.
that people have forgotten that cutting government spending is taking money from their cousin, their brother, their dad, their uncle, their sister, their mom.
The bottom line is a terrible thing to live up to or live down to, I guess.
Right, right. Well, we're a consumer society, Zach. So the reason I say government is the only one that can create jobs is the function of a consumer society from a government standpoint should be to see to it that every consumer has enough money to spend.
Right.
Now, if you want to be the kind of person that says we work 7 or 3:30, but I'm going to get there at 6 and I'm going to stay till 4:30, then you got more to spend. But everybody should be somehow entitled to work to earn something that gives them a dignified life. That's what unions stand for. We don't want all the money. We just want enough to say, you know what, man? I got a cool little house out in the nice part of town, and I got a car, and my wife's got a car.
Yeah.
And, you know, twice a year we can afford to get away for the weekend and that. I don't care if I can fly off to Europe every third weekend.
Yeah.
You know, that is not my goal in life. And that shouldn't be what we guarantee everybody. But everybody ought to be able to say, I'm willing to get up in the morning and go to work. They should be able to make a dignified earning.
So when they try to say that methods that unions use and tactics they use to give their labor forces what they're asking for and media campaigns, and when you hear governments saying that they have to stop following the rules that the unions have placed before them, and you hear like just for instance Wisconsin and the other state, what is it?
Ohio.
Yeah, when you hear them saying you know, we're going to take money away from pensions and public unionized labor. Why do people agree with that? How come people can't see it this way?
Well, because it's been a concerted effort for the last pretty much almost 40 years that they've bought the media, the conservatives. And so what they've got is everybody believing in this abstract cut government. Well, what are you going to cut?
Yeah.
cutting something costs everybody money. And so what they have to understand is that There is no way to take money out of government without everyone suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Because the paradox of it all is, it isn't the people that live in subsidized housing on food stamps that cost us money, because they don't have access to enough money. It's the people that cause things like the ridiculous bailout of the banks and stuff.
And
they
cause
the problem. Yeah, the oil spills.
Like
they cause the
giant corporations.
Yeah, of course. You know, and it's not because they're evil people. You know, the one thing I think that gets lost, I'm going to go off on a tangent here, but
that's okay.
My whole thing, why I don't like the people, the so-called radio pundits, you know, the Rush Limbaughs and Sean Hannitys and Glenn Becks, is not because of what they say. They're entitled to be as conservative as they want and as right-wing as they want. What I don't like about them is they create division. Mm-hmm. They're not trying to unite the country and say, let's come up with the best solution. They tell you, you either believe what I do or you're the enemy and we should kill you.
Yeah.
And that's why we don't have any unity in this country. Exactly. Because the truth is, we all want the same thing.
We do, yeah.
We just got a different route to get to that destination.
That's right.
And they make us divided instead of united.
Well, that's a perfect way to govern a body of people, is two divided people.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, what is it every time? Presidential elections have the highest turnover in votes, and it's always like 49 to 50.
Yeah.
It's always just right down the middle.
Yep.
That's terrible.
Yep.
That's not democracy.
No.
That's not representation.
No. No. But you see, it's because we've become so enamored with money, you know, and the thing that astounds me, I think, the most is that because of what I do, you know, as a writer, which really means what I am as a reader, excuse me, people have no idea of the background of stuff, you know, and what I mean by no idea of the background of various things is, like the Koch brothers that everybody makes a big issue out of, you know, that they finance the Tea Party and they do this and they do that and so on and so forth. Well, do you know how their family got their fortune?
Hmm.
Their dad went to Russia and built all of Stalin's oil wells.
Wow.
Yeah.
Soviet.
So he's the capitalist that would sell you the rope you're going to hang him with.
You know, I always get upset.
Isn't that interesting? He's the guy that created all the wealth for Stalin. Because he created the oil wells. He went over and built them because he had the expertise.
The Koch brothers.
The Koch brothers' dad.
These guys who have been
in
Kansas. In the scene.
Yeah.
They've been, you know, somehow supporting tea parties with all their millions of dollars and whatnot.
Yeah. Their dad built Stalin's oil wells.
Huh.
That's where their family money started.
In the USSR.
Yeah. This was back in the 30s.
In a, you know, the complete opposite side of the right.
Yeah.
The extreme left.
Yeah.
The USSR.
Yeah. Well, it was the totalitarian dictatorship by Stalin, you know, Joseph Stalin. And, you know, I mean, he knew what he was doing.
Well, the USSR started off well.
Well,
it had a
good
idea.
Well,
know,
whether they did or
groups
didn't.
Groups of Soviets is what they called, you know.
Yeah, but socialism doesn't work.
No.
Socialism doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
My point is that it's interesting that the guys that are so pro-private sector, right-wing, anti-this and that, got their start by building Stalin's oil wells.
I always get upset when I see their name had been, the you know, H.R. Koch or whatever his name is. It's at the end of a PBS program that I really enjoy, and I'm terribly sad that they gave away all their money to something I think is so left and important, like public broadcasting, you know, public radio, public works.
Very important.
Public employees.
And again, what upsets me is that because of the Rush Limbaughs and Sean Hannitys and their divisiveness, we can't seem to have adult conversations about that stuff. You know, it's like global warming. You know, whether you think it is or isn't real, it's been reduced to a political, ideological debate, as opposed to a scientific debate.
Or a solution debate.
Yeah, there's no solutions offered.
No.
There's no...
It's just...
It's all either you're for it or against it. But you know what causes that?
Defining. It's a defining mechanism. Now I'm defined as this, and now I will do this and this and that. I'll vote this way. I'll be this way. I'll purchase these things.
Well, you know what causes that is we've made such an issue in this country out of people that change their mind. And so what happens is, most people aren't aware of this, Karl Rove's supposed political genius, which he's not, he's just a man with no conscience, is create conventional wisdom. So in other words, if you get everybody the first 10 days of the news cycle believing something, then, excuse me, a week later when everybody discovers that the facts are somewhat different, it doesn't matter, because if you've been arguing at the local bar or the local breakfast cafe, you're not going to stand up and say, you know, by the way, everybody, I was a fool because I got duped.
Yeah.
How else do people like Sarah Palin manage to get any kind of traction?
Manufacturing consent.
Exactly.
Noam Chomsky.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's also, you know, it actually comes out of the CIA and Radio Free Europe. It's called confirmation bias. They use the concept of confirmation bias.
Radio Free Europe?
Yeah, Yeah, the CIA developed it all. And in other words, what you do is you create a medium that people believe, which is what they did with Fox News. They created
papers.
A medium that people believe. And so now whatever it is they say, people believe it.
It's gospel.
Yeah, it's gospel. and in fact, they get you conditioned that when someone says, no, those aren't the facts, they say, well, my facts are just as accurate as yours. Mm-hmm. Because they wouldn't say it on TV if it wasn't true.
So how do we wake up from this American dream?
I don't think we do until things like Scott Walker in Wisconsin happen. I think he kicked the sleeping dog. You know,
sleeping dragon. Let's go.
Yeah, for sure.
Let's make it a more powerful metaphor.
Yeah, there you go. He definitely stepped on the tail of a dragon, okay?
Yeah.
No question of a doubt.
Do you know of any current events that are going on in Wisconsin with those issues?
Well, the recalls, you know, they're in full swing up there. And
recalling him.
No.
Recalling the bill?
The various senators, some of the various senators, you know, they have the recall petition circulating.
In the Wisconsin Senate?
Yeah, and Wisconsin House, too, both. They're trying to recall some of the people. Excuse me, but...
The last thing that I knew about the Wisconsin going-ons was that Judge Sumi, who declared it unconstitutional for the bill to pass.
Right, so it's not in effect yet. And so it's going to have to work its way through that state Supreme Court. Before anything happens with it.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It needed to get slowed down and stopped. I mean, and again, you know, not to get on my soapbox here, but...
No, well, that's what this is for. Yeah, it's community radio.
Yeah, is, you know, the deliberate use of misinformation in America today is astounding.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's absolutely astounding. Because that's what I mean when I say like a Fox News. If they've got you conditioned to watch Fox News, when they go on television and talk or they make any public appearance, they know they're talking to their Fox audience. Mm-hmm. So a John Boehner last week can talk in New York to the Council of Economic People and he can say the stimulus didn't work and it cost us jobs when just exactly the opposite is what happened. But it's okay because then when Fox News runs it, the people that believe in Fox News are going to say, see, Obama's stimulus didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
without any real facts.
Yeah, with no facts.
No.
In fact, the facts are exactly opposite.
Yeah.
The facts are exactly the opposite. You know, it's just like Reagan, you know. I'm not a particular fan of Reagan because of what he did to Patco, but by the same token, he raised taxes 11 times.
Yeah. And shut down factories and jobs all across America.
Yeah. No, what I mean by he raised taxes 11 times, in fact, when he was governor of California, he instituted the largest state income tax increase ever. Ever. There's the largest state tax increase ever in California. Okay? And the reason is because no matter what else he was a pragmatic leader of the organization, which meant he knew he had to have X amount of revenue to operate it. And what's happened is they've bastardized his theory now. People like that goofy Grover Norquist, you know, and Club for Growth and those kind of people. And to them, there is no such thing as a good tax. Hmm. Well, without taxes, we don't have roads.
Yeah,
we don't have schools.
Nothing.
We have no police. We don't have any fire. We don't have anything. I mean, it's ridiculous.
You know, I'm in favor of more tax. And give me free things in return. You know, I'd like to see great mass transit. Brought to me by my tax dollars.
Absolutely.
I'd like to see health.
Absolutely.
Brought to me by my health dollars, my tax dollars. And increased education and easier access to knowledge. All brought to me by my payments to the strong government that I've instilled in the land by my, you know, observance of its authority.
Absolutely.
But instead, all I have among me is, you know, people who want to give me more money so I can spend it at private places just to have something I'm going to throw away, something that's obsolete in a month, you know,
so
garbage. So
you can buy another one.
Just so I can buy another one.
Yep.
Perceived obsolescence, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Planned obsolescence.
Yeah, absolutely it is. It's absolutely planned obsolescence. And that's pathetic, you know, because...
A little public planning would make the place a whole lot better.
You know, that's just like Social Security. Well, that's another whole complete subject, Social Security.
Yeah.
You know, that's so phony, the argument about Social Security.
About it potentially failing?
Yeah. Yeah, that's so phony. Social Security's in great shape.
Really? I mean,
well, for one.
How do we know that?
Okay, here's why. What happened is when Reagan became president in the early 80s, you know, 1980, he was elected and took office January 81, they sat back and they took a look at Social Security and they realized it wasn't going to make it with that large cohort of baby boomers.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So he tasked Tip O'Neill, who was Speaker of the House, and Bob Dole, who was Senate President, majority leader in the Senate at that time, because Republicans actually controlled the Senate. He said, fix Social Security. So they spent about a year and they hashed their way through it. And what they did was they got everybody to agree to double the tax. That's when it went from 6.5% to 13%, okay? And it was like, okay, we're going to take twice as much out of workers' paychecks and we're going to take twice as much from the business. So in other words, the business pays half your Social Security and you pay the other half, okay? And the reason we're going to do that is because we have calculated that if we take Social Security taxes from 90% of all earned income in the United States, we'll be fine. And that will create this huge trust fund that will last until the baby boomers are died off in 2037. Okay?
Okay.
So that's why they always say, oh, it's going to go broke around 2037 or 2036. Well, it's supposed to go broke, the trust fund. Okay? Not Social Security. The trust fund is, because the trust fund was designed to go that long to take care of the baby boomers.
Yeah, that amount of the people who they anticipate retiring.
Right. So first off, they're lying about that, you know, the trust fund wasn't designed to last into perpetuity and didn't start out in perpetuity.
But we're all still paying into it.
Yeah, of course, because that's...
So there should be like another ball of money that's being waited right, to anticipate
which there
the
is,
retirement.
Which there is. That's what I'm saying. What we pay in is what's going to be there, okay, when people retire. So for one, and now the second thing about that that's interesting, okay, is that Reagan's plan was that we have to capture Social Security on 90% of all earned income. And at the time in 1983 when they instituted it, I don't remember, so please don't quote me, people, don't write into the radio station, but it was around like $67,000 is where it cut off, okay? You know, they didn't collect Social Security anymore after that, okay? Well, now we only collect Social Security on 84% of all earned income.
Okay.
And the reason is we've lost 6% of the income because with the tax laws saying that if it's capital gains, you don't have to pay Social Security on it.
Privatists who have legislated with their big money and big lobbies to make government, what they say, small and deregulate markets and their business has caused Social Security to potentially fail.
Right. And the reason, they've caused it to have less revenue than it could have.
Right.
So first thing to remember, if we were going to actually capture Social Security taxes on 90% of earned income, instead of it cutting off at $106,000, it would go up to $182,000. So in other words, we should collect it all the way up to $182,000, not $106,000 where it cuts off now, okay? And the second thing is that people have to understand that how can it go anywhere? Every person that works is contributing to it.
Yeah.
So it can't go broke. That's so phony when they say it's going to go broke. How can it go broke?
I mean, we don't use any of those revenues for anything else. It just sits there and waits for all of
No. They use it time.
Okay.
But when they say, I've seen, you know, George Bush and his famous, I've seen the box of IOUs. Well, those IOUs are government treasury bonds. So if you're telling me those IOUs are no good, then the treasury bonds that they own in China are no good. The treasury bonds that me and you own are no good.
Yeah.
Right? The full faith and credit of the United States is good on those just like it is on anything. And it's the incoming revenue that pays those. So it's complicated.
That's a big whole other topic. We could probably do it for another day.
You could do an entire show on Social Security. And
maybe
how
we should.
Yeah, and exactly. I'd love to. You know, because they really have muddled the waters so much. Like I said, first thing to realize is the trust fund that's going to go out in 2037 was designed to go out in 2037.
Well, let's get back to our local unions.
Okay.
That was great. Big tangent, but that was a really good discussion. Yeah. What are some of the projects that local unions, you know, are being able to get involved with?
Well,
labor and
like I say, I work for the building trades, and, you know, these are some really, really skilled people. They are very highly skilled. I mean, do you realize if you become an electrician, you got the equivalent of a master's degree?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they have to go through thousands of hours of on-the-job training. They have to go through hundreds and hundreds of hours of classroom training. They have to pass tests. They have to be, you know, I mean, they automatically get an associate's degree if they want to go through ICC in the program and so on.
The IEBW is one of the strongest unions around.
Yeah, absolutely, because they have skilled people. And so what happens is it becomes a circle. In other words, if you really truly want the highly trained people, you have to go to the unions. And the reason is they have the structured, monitored, and certified training programs. Now, I'm not saying that there's no way to learn how to do something other than go through the union program, because obviously lots of people learn how to do lots of things in life, okay?
Sure.
But if you just want to say, I want to call somebody to have them build this building. Well, then, duh. If you don't have any personal friends, family, or expertise in construction, it only makes sense to go to the people that you know, whether you know them personally or not, went through the program. Just like you probably don't know your doctor personally that operates on you, okay? But you know he went to a certified school that offered him a degree program.
Yeah, you're not going to call Acme Builders.
Yeah, you're not going to call Acme Builders. Yeah. You know, now maybe if Acme Builders is run by your brother-in-law's cousin and he knows him real well and he says, trust me, they're going to do okay, you at least then have a reasonable chance of getting a good product.
And you can expect to pay a lower price for a shoddy job.
Yeah, but the truth is a guy with a pickup truck and a toolbox is not a contractor.
That's right. So they're building the Bass Pro Shop.
Oh, yeah.
Downtown Museum.
Downtown Museum. They built the Children's Hospital. They just finished the Children's Hospital earlier this year, last year, actually last summer, the Milestone Project. And, you know, I mean, we're talking unbelievable stuff. You know,
Are those some of the biggest places that are being built of late for skilled labor?
No question. And think about when they do the hospital, two things. They have to not shut the hospital down, obviously, and yet they have to make sure that they're not causing any problems with existing people because they can't shut the hospital down. You have to be careful about dust. You have to be careful about contamination. I mean, it's phenomenal, not to mention the incredible technology now that is involved with putting together something like Children's Hospital. You know,
is there any skilled labor that focuses on green technology?
Absolutely.
You know, sustainability?
All the trades.
Really? Yeah,
every single one of the trades focus extensively on that. There's the LEED. There's the whole LEED project.
LEED.
Yeah, LEED. That's a whole show. We'll do another whole show on that, okay? But that's like very sustainable projects. You know, I did an article about Core Construction out in Morton, and they were one of the first to jump on that. And now all the contractors around town are, you know, subscribing to it, you know, which is its materials, its products. You know, I'll tell you something else that is really interesting, speaking of while we're on this, about the unions and the projects. One of the undiscovered secrets for someone that is listening to this, if you have children that you're not sure what they want to do with life, is that the union apprenticeship programs are every bit as viable as a college education. Absolutely, positively, 100%, every bit as viable as a college education. Do you realize the Carpenter's School down at Pekin actually even has dormitories?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they even have dormitories like a regular school, because people from the whole Central Illinois District Council of Carpenters, that's where they go to get trained. And you don't have to be an apprentice to go there to get trained. You can be a journeyman and say, hey, I need to learn how to do this because my contractor just bid a job and in 6 months we're going to start doing this. So I need to learn how to install such and such, or I need to learn how to do this. And they say, come on down for a week.
So it's like it's an army of workers.
Yeah.
We know how to do everything exactly correct.
Yeah, with each other. Yeah. With each other. That's the other beauty of when you hire the union skilled trades. You know, they know how to coordinate with each other.
Oh, each individual expertise.
Yeah, right. I mean, obviously the plumbers know what the electricians are doing, and the electricians know what the carpenters are doing, and the carpenters know what the steam fitters are doing. Whether they do that trade or not, you know, it's about being coordinated, you know. And
do students have to pay to go to that carpenter
school? No, no.
In fact, they get paid.
They get paid.
Wow.
In fact, they actually get paid.
And that's all built on sort of just like a tax would be, your union dues.
Well, yeah, you pay for it. You know, when you belong to the union and they deduct money out of your check, but actually it's the contractors that pay for the training. You know, they do a check-off. You know, the contractors pay so much per hour for guys that work for them.
The dues check-off system?
No, the contractors do. Contractors make a contribution based on the number of hours of the people they have working. And they do that because that, of course, then keeps them in a constant supply of highly skilled people.
Yeah.
So it's only in their interest to do that.
Okay.
You know, just like it's in Caterpillar's interest to support Bradley University. Of course they support Bradley. They support ICC, the Quest program. That's a fabulous, fabulous thing that Caterpillar does.
Yeah.
I mean, it really truly is. The Quest program is a great thing, you know.
Well, Chris, this is great.
Yeah.
We've hit on lots of topics. Running out of time, though.
Okay.
So
thank you,
I'd love for you to come back.
Oh, I'll come back anytime, Zach. Give me a call.
Great, I will. Thanks a lot, Chris.
You betcha.
Get you a man that's a union man. Join the ladies' auxiliary. Married life ain't hard. You're packing a union card. And a The married man has a happy life if he's got a union wife. So you can't
scare me, I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union.
Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union.
I'm sticking to the union until the day I die.
We'd like to thank Chris for coming on our show, and we hope to have him on our show again. Well, our hour's about up. Recently, Mike Perillo, a contributor to Solidarity Journal, went to Madison, Wisconsin. He brought back several pieces of actuality audio to give our listeners a feel of his experience up there. I'd like to end the show with that. As always, thanks for listening to Solidarity Journal on WAZU 90.7 FM, Peoria's one and only Pacifica Radio affiliate. And our community voice. Peace and solidarity.
Because it started here in Madison, Wisconsin, as we go through our lives, one of the proudest things we're going to be able to say is that we were in Madison. Ladies and gentlemen, for an invocation, and you're going to love this person's last name. You're going to love her. Ladies and gentlemen, Rabbi Dina Feingold.
Good afternoon, Madison.
And now we have to make sure that we don't let them down this summer as well, right? So I give you from the State Senate, State Senator John Erbenbach.
Good to see you all again. It is so good to see you again. Before I get going to my little talk, there's two introductions I'd like to make. I'd like to bring up my son, Joey Erpenbach, who made sure the house stayed clean while I was gone, went to school and did his homework. And my daughter, Amy, who couldn't make it here today because she doesn't like crowds, she says. I'd also like to bring up my mom, Liz Erpenbach. She, while I was gone, made sure Joey went to school and made sure Amy did her homework and made sure that they didn't have any parties at the house. My mom did that along with the fabulous men and women of the Wisconsin State Patrol, who stop by the house every once in a while. Anyways, it's good to see you again. Our work is really cut out for us. We all know what the stakes are here. We know Governor Scott Walker's war on the middle class has just begun, and we are not backing down from that war. We are not rolling over. We're not giving up. We are going to fight. We're going to fight from one end of this state to the other. It's not a fight we choose. This is a fight that Scott Walker has thrown upon all of us, and we will not back down. We will not back down. The budget that Scott Walker has introduced along with the rest of the Republicans has absolutely no heart, has absolutely no compassion, continues to go after the workers of the middle class of the state of Wisconsin, up and down the state. It goes after our seniors. It goes after our kids in schools. It goes after everything we value and cherish here in the state of Wisconsin. And we're not going to let that happen. We are not going to let that happen. So here's what we need from you. This will be the last time I expect to see any of you here in Madison. You need to campaign across the state, and you have any number of places to go.
Yes.
You can vacation up in Minocqua and help out Jim Holpert.
Yes.
You can spend some time in Green Bay and make sure Dave Hansen holds on to his seat.
Woo.
And also Bob Wirch down in Kenosha.
Yes.
Or you can go to La Crosse, which is beautiful this time of year, and spend some time with Jennifer Schilling. Or you can go up to Hudson, and you can campaign up there. You can campaign in central Wisconsin. You can campaign in suburban Milwaukee. The point is, you have your choice, but you have to do it. We need your help now. We need your help. We need you to go make phone calls. We need you to pass out literature. We need you to do doors. We need you to donate a buck or two right across the street. When we're all done here, go across the street. The coordinated campaign is over there waiting to talk to you and take a couple of dollars off of your pocket, if at all possible. We certainly could use the help. In order for us to do what we're supposed to do as Democrats here in Wisconsin, we have to have a governor who's going to be working with us. We have to have a governor who not only stands with what he calls the taxpayers of Wisconsin, because we are all taxpayers, but he doesn't stand with us. He doesn't do anything for us. He doesn't help us. He doesn't make sure our K-12 education system is as strong as it possibly can be. He is trying to close those doors. We can't let that happen. We can't let that happen. So it starts with getting back the state Senate. The Democrats in the state Senate need your help. We really do. If we get the majority back, it will force Scott Walker into something he's never ever done before, actually sit down with a Democrat and have to negotiate and bargain back and forth across from one another at the same table. I want to tell you something. I know the Republicans are watching what we're doing, and that's fine. But the rest of the nation is watching too. It started here in Madison, Wisconsin, with taking away workers' rights. They tried to do that in less than a week. It started here in Madison, Wisconsin, and it's going to end here in Wisconsin. We are going to show the nation what we are all about. We are going to show the nation. Our next speaker, I wish I had his passion. I really do.
Thank you, John Erpenbach.
Ben Maskey, Liberty Church.
Here we are months later, 20,000 at the state capitol. And Wisconsin has risen as never before. In every village and town, by the hundreds of thousands, we have risen. Every nation in the world knows the name Wisconsin. And after we had done all this, why on earth would Wisconsinites accept the poison that has been prescribed for us? Why? We've turned the tide. We've turned the tide. We don't back down. It's time for Scott Walker to back down. And you know, there's going to be many important struggles. You've heard the calls for the recalls. You've heard the calls to get out for the elections next year. But in the next month, we have a struggle that we are in the midst of. And that is a struggle to reject this state budget. We reject this budget. We reject this budget. It is a budget which has weakened and divided Wisconsin as never before. It's done that because it targets millions of Wisconsinites, millions of us, threatens to push people who are struggling to survive below the surface. And the budget, of course, it wasn't drawn up through public hearings. There were meetings in small rooms that took place between politicians and corporate lobbyists, and they came up with their plans to tax the poor, to feed the rich. And we say, we reject your budget! We We reject your budget! Your budget! We reject your budget! We reject your budget! We reject your budget! We reject your budget! And you know, we reject their budget, and now the legislature has to decide. Those individual legislators have to decide, do they continue to play along, or do they finally wake up and listen to their constituents in every part of the state who have said, vote this budget down, start again, go to the people, ask us what our priorities are, and we'll see what they decide. We'll see what they decide.
Wake up!
Wake up! That's right. I heard the shout, wake up. But I'll tell you, whether we win today or whether we win tomorrow, the drive for democracy in Wisconsin will continue to move forward. It will continue to move forward. Because this is not just about budget priorities and economic justice on this day in which we had the invocation, the call for Jubilee. It is not merely a call for economic justice. It is a call for democracy in Wisconsin. We need to clean up state government. We need to make sure this never happens before. We need to kick the corporate lobbyists out of the Capitol. Because I'll tell you, this will happen again if we let it. What we are involved in today is not a struggle for the soul of Wisconsin. It is a struggle for the survival of Wisconsin. And because we are fiercely proud of our state, because we love Wisconsin, because we love the progressive tradition, which is synonymous with Wisconsin, we will fight, we will win, we will bring the drive for democracy forward. And we have proven today that we have the ability to turn tens of thousands out of the Capitol whenever we so choose. So those of you in this temple of democracy, beware! We've come to reclaim democracy. And I'll tell you one other thing. Just yesterday, I was blessed, my wife and I were blessed with five eagles, five bald eagles out in Richland County. And she turned to me and she said, you know, we're not Native American, right? But if we were, we would know they were telling us something. They're saying, independence is going to come back to Wisconsin. We're going to win this fight. I take that as a sign. Well, thank you for everything you're doing. And I want to introduce the next generation. Members of the next generation, please welcome Christian, who's representing the youth of Voces de la Frontera from Milwaukee.